said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. I mean, that's one of the things that was, this pot. They made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
They ignored it because they wanted it to happen.
Every one starts with a false flag operation.
Along the shore, the cloud waves break. The twin suns sink behind the lake. The shadows lengthen in Carcosa. Hello, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of Historica Esoterica. I'm your friend, Sweet Baby Roswell, and I'm joined by...
your enemy, bitter old Matt Kaeldra.
Matt, how are you?
I'm pretty good. I like that we both, like, after 45 minutes of pre-show discussion, have settled into NPR voice so we can start recording.
I realized when I slightly moved my headphone off of my ear that I've been, like, yelling into the microphone for the past 30 minutes. So I thought we'd take it down for this episode because this is going to be kind of a spooky, I think, a little bit chill episode where we discuss a very interesting collection of short stories by a man named Robert W. Chambers called The King in Yellow, which has been sort of an inspiration for a lot of media, notably H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, all of the Cthulhu mythos and any like old god eldritch type of science fiction, and then more recently True Detective season one. So we're going to be discussing the original story about the King in Yellow and what that is, kind of talking about the beats of three of the different short stories that appear at the beginning of the book. But how would you describe this collection of stories, Matthew?
I think, well, it's interesting, right? It is, many people argue it's one of the first examples of weird fiction, which has always been my favorite way to describe it, because later on that sort of morphed into cosmic horror, is what they also call it. But in its earlier stages, it was just called weird fiction, which somehow I like a little bit more.
Yeah, I do too.
The idea of just like rifts in a reality appearing as ancient gods enter the world. And you're like, ooh, this is pretty weird.
That's weird. Honestly, I mean, in this day and age, I think that's how people would react if like a Cthulhu popped his head out of the sky. You'd be like, oh, that's weird. I have to go to work now.
Yeah, pretty much. And then he sort of bounced around genres. I've got a couple notes on our boy Chambers.
He did a lot of romance later in his life to kind of like make a pretty penny.
Yeah. So he wrote some romance. He also wrote a lot of historical fiction. He was very interested in like the Franco-Prussian War or just European wars in general.
Yeah.
Which bleeds through in this as well.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious. Yeah. He was kind of criticized, I thought, on some of his historical fiction.
People don't like it as much as they like this. The King in Yellow, it's worth noting, it was 10 short stories.
Yeah.
And the first four of them comprised like the King in Yellow. They referenced the King in Yellow. Beyond that, it's just sort of more of the same. There's some historical fiction. There's one story, I think, about people who time travel.
Yeah,
It's just him kind of doing his own thing.
Yeah, and I think like all like they all like will mention some of that lore that relates to it in some way, but after the first four stories, it kind of drops off a little bit and becomes less of that weird horror fiction relating directly to it, and the rest of it kind of becomes like a backdrop. Like it becomes a backdrop to whatever story is going on.
Yeah, it stops being weird fiction, capital W, and just starts being weird fiction, lowercase W.
Yeah, which is fine.
Which, you know, as Bobby Rooms, as I like to call him, just sort of like, he did write a lot.
Sorry, I was trying to decode that in my mind. That's stupid.
Yeah. Don't worry. I spent about 10 seconds coming up with that one, so I'm not offended. But yeah, so he did write some more weird fiction later on in his career, which was not as well received as The King in Yellow. And it's nowadays it's not as well remembered either, because even though I think The Maker of Moons is an even cooler name.
That's a sick title.
It didn't catch on amongst the Cthulhu mythos users of the 1920s who sort of expanded all this.
Yeah. Looking at you, August Derleff. Did you think was there anything that stood out to you about his life? Because there was nothing to me that I think is super interesting to talk about, except for one thing, which I'd like to read to, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
This is just pulled straight from the Wikipedia, but it's from his biography, where it says, quote, his parents met when his mother was 12 years old and his father was interning with her father, Joseph Boughton, a prominent corporate lawyer, end quote. And based on their age gap, which was 15 years, that means his father met his mother when he was 27, my current age, and she was a 12-year-old child. Which
very,
is
very young.
Even for like 1800s, that's weird, right?
Yeah, no. So I would like to note, I have three biographical notes about him.
Okay.
The first one is, his parents met when his mother was 12 and his father was 27. In parentheses, yikes. And then underneath that, just sort of something I thought was kind of interesting. He was initially an artist and then pivoted to writing. And his brother was an architect. And now both painters and architects feature heavily in these books. So I figured that's worth noting. And then finally, this one, I couldn't really make it mean anything. I really wanted to, but I just, I couldn't figure out if it was relevant or not. But he's the descendant of Roger Williams, who was like one of the founders of like a city in Rhode Island. Like, so his family are like old WASPs.
Yeah.
But none of like the super evil ones who are particularly notable, just like the kind of ambiently evil ones who just were hanging out.
Yeah. The chill WASPs.
Yeah.
You know? The Yellow Jackets. Are Yellow Jackets?
The King in Yellow Jackets.
Okay, come on. All right. You redeemed yourself. So that's kind of who he is. Just like a very, like, born 1865, so very, like, 1800s fella. The King in Yellow came out in 1895, so not long before the turn of the century. I think that's actually the year J.R.R. Tolkien was born. Sorry, that's a dumb bit of trivia.
I did not realize that he was born. I guess it makes sense.
Yeah.
He fought in World War I, but still.
Yeah. Right. I'm going to, just so nobody gets mad at me, I'm going to double check myself on that. 1892. I was close.
Yeah. Okay.
I was close. But so like we're looking at late 1800s when this comes out. So your Victorian era kind of weird fantasy.
Yeah. And oh boy, do his Victorian sensibilities sort of bleed into these stories.
Absolutely.
The only other notes about like his life that I have, I think we'll do after our little our little synopsis of the little tales.
Yeah.
Did you have anything more to say before we just sort of launch into it?
No. I think we'll go ahead and launch into, I think, the first story in our collection, which is The Repairer of Reputations.
Strange is the night where black stars rise, and strange moons circle through the skies, but stranger still is lost Carcosa.
Alrighty. So, the first story, The Repairer of Reputations, I guess I'll have you kind of go through this one and kind of describe the plot, and I'll join in with you.
The Repairer of Reputations, I believe it's the longest story.
Yes.
When I was reading it, it certainly felt like it was. But to be clear, it's not a bad thing. This might be my favorite of the four.
Interesting. Okay.
So it takes place in what was, at the time, a future version of New York in the 1920s.
Right.
Which I had to keep reminding myself that it was like a dystopian future.
It was pretty confusing to read, you know, like now, especially being someone who's not like super familiar with the 1920s, you know, and 30s, you know, aside from World War II. So I was like, did this stuff happen? And a lot of it obviously didn't.
Yeah, but it is, it's kind of weird because it does sort of, in some ways, echo what did happen, right? Like he mentions that, like, in the early 1900s, there's a great war in Europe.
Yeah.
And the only difference is that apparently Tsarist Russia won.
which that's no good.
Twist ending.
Yeah.
But yeah, like from the very beginning of this one, you can tell that the narrator, you're not supposed to be on this guy's side. Because in this version of America in the 1920s, yes, it's this dystopian future. The narrator, like, for instance, the first and like most obvious example is that he like talks about how there was, I don't remember what it was, like the Congress for Racial Tolerance or something like that.
But,
like,
yeah,
outlawed religious bigotry. And then in the next,
the Congress of Religions.
Yeah, the Congress of Religions. And then in the next paragraph, he mentions that like all Jews and black people have been banned from the nation.
Yes. I can actually read you the quote.
Please,
I'm looking
yeah,
at it right here. He says, quote, "We had profited well by the latest treaties with France and England, the exclusion of foreign-born Jews as a measure of self-preservation, the settlement of the new independent N-word state of Suwannee, the checking of the immigration, the new laws concerning naturalization, the gradual centralization of power in the executive, all contributed to the national calm and propriety. When the government solved the Indian problem, the squadrons of Indian cavalry scouts in native costume were substituted for the pitiable organizations tacked on the tail of skeletonized regiments by the former Secretary of War. The nation drew a long sigh of relief when, after the colossal Congress of Religions, bigotry and intolerance were laid in their graves and kindness and charity began to draw warring sects together. Many thought the millennium had arrived at last in the new world, which, after all, is a world by itself." So that's, I remember reading that and being like, oh, I thought we were done with anti-Semitism after last episode, but no, we're back.
Yeah.
I can never escape.
Unfortunately, it seems like just because he was a Protestant in the 1800s, I imagine he was probably a little anti-Semitic. But I can fortunately say this is clearly not meant to be a good thing in the context of the story.
It's supposed to make you go like, ew.
Ooh, that's not good. So, hey, we're doing better than Bobby Fischer.
We are. We're doing better than Bobby Fischer. I think another glaring kind of sore on this, like, version of the, you know, future to the Victorians was that there is now the laws prohibiting suicide were taken away, repealed. And now the first government lethal chamber opened in Washington Square Park, which is pretty, that kind of made me chuckle. That was kind of a funny thing because I'm like, man, he was only like 100 years off, because I'm pretty sure we have lethal chambers somewhere in Europe these days, right?
Oh, yeah. I also, it's interesting because these, the stories sort of, they all like are loosely connected. The first four and then the later ones as well all take place within the same universe.
Right.
And there's a sort of a clever setup in this case as in this like lethal chamber. Hang on here, let me find it. "A splendid marble group of the Fates stood before the door, a work of a young American sculptor, Boris Yvain, who had died in Paris when he was only 23 years old." Which is just interesting.
Yeah, that comes back to play in the next story, which we will discuss. But yeah, that was one of the things I did really appreciate about, I think, at least for the first few stories, like they just sort of get better and better as they go, because they build on each other in a really fascinating way, which is why I think my favorite is not the first one, but because it does have to do a lot of leg work and lore drop to like.
Yeah, the other ones do. They reward you for paying attention to the other stories, which
absolutely.
I love.
I do like that. Yeah. So anyway, it's being narrated by our narrator. What is it? Hildred Castanet?
I read it as Castane.
Castane. Thank you.
Or Castigny. However you want to pronounce it.
We can just continue to butcher French on this podcast.
Yeah,
out of principle.
Yeah, so it's narrated by our boy Hildred, who very casually mentions that he like fell off his horse and hit his head.
Yes.
And was briefly taken off to an asylum. But later on, everybody realized that this was a grievous mistake. And of course, he hadn't been insane. And in fact, he gets murderously angry anytime anyone uses the word lunatic.
Yes, exactly. So we know he's a sane, normal, steady as she goes type of guy.
Yeah. Like later on in the story, I believe someone like it says, like, "Are you insane?" And he's like, It was only like the kindness in my heart that spared him from dying in that where he stood. It's like, oh yeah, that's the sort of thing a lunatic wouldn't think.
But so as we meet him, he's kind of crossing through New York and kind of like viewing these changes, which are kind of like how we get our backstory. Mm-hmm. You know, like he's seeing them march to like the opening of this lethal chamber, as he heads to an armorer named Hawberk. Whose daughter is like romantically entangled with his cousin.
Yeah.
But the reason he visits is because there's a man who lives above the armorer's shop.
There's one thing of note about this armorer before we visit.
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
So, of course, Hawberk, which is a side note, I love really just stupidly obvious puns. Yes. Incredible.
Yes.
Hawberk and, yeah, his daughter Constance are just, you know, they're hanging out. And he mentions, just sort of offhandedly, Hawberk does, that he's going, of course, that Hildred has visited to meet that old lunatic upstairs, Wild, who we will get to momentarily.
Right.
But Hildred is a little less convinced that our friend Wild is insane. He seems to think, no, he's got some knowledge. For instance, he knows where these missing pieces of a very rare set of armor are. And the Prince's Emblazoned is what it's called. And so Hildred just sort of casually reveals that, and Hawberk gets very surprised. And then, of course, he reveals that he believes Hildred to be the Marquis of Avonshire, which is to say an English noble who has fled following Russia just destroying all of Europe in World War One. Well, not
he
World
believes
War I,
but... Hawberk.
Yes, Hawberk is the Marquis of Avonshire.
Following
did I say Wild?
You said Hildred.
Oops. Okay, look, there's a lot of names bouncing around my head right now.
No worries.
And I'm skimming through the book as I read, trying to, remember the name of the Marquis. So Constance and Hawberk react to this with nervousness and... Yeah. Very casual dismissal.
Yeah. According to our unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
But.
And that's the other thing, right? Of course, as we go through, it becomes more and more obvious that he is insane.
Yes.
And it's very funny imagining, because initially you're like, wow, this guy's the Marquis of Avonshire. Like, he's been found out.
Yeah.
And then you look back on it and you're like, or maybe this insane man just rolled up to his shop and was like, I know that you are a duke. And he responded the way that any of us would, which is like, what? No.
No.
No. Please go upstairs now.
Yeah.
Then he goes up and he meets Mr. Wild, the titular repairer of reputations, who is, you know, in one of the charmingly dated aspects of this story. It's the classic, oof, this guy's ugly enough. He has to be evil.
Yeah. He's a small, bald, like...
He has a flat head.
He's got a flat head. He's got mechanical ears.
Yeah, he has like fake ears. He doesn't have ears. And his left hand has no fingers.
Yes. So he's a monster, I guess. He's a bad guy. So he's an interesting character. Like, you immediately, you're like, okay, this guy's sort of strange. He's got a crazy cat that he likes to like fight with.
Yeah, he and his cat just constantly are trying to murder each other.
Which is pretty sick. And so him and Mr. Wild and our main character Hildred seem to sort of have a rapport and an understanding, and this is where we're first sort of like introduced to the fact that about what a repairer of reputations is,
mm-hmm.
Which definitely made my third eye open a little bit.
Oh,
do you
want
to talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, I might just read like the part where he just sort of is going through the ledger, just to sort of give an idea of what he does. Here it is. Mr. Wild had climbed into his high chair, and after studying my face, picked up a dog-eared ledger and opened it. Henry B. Matthews, he read, bookkeeper with Wisot, Wisot & Company, dealers in church ornaments, called April 3rd, reputation damaged on the racetrack, known as a welcher, reputation to be repaired by August 1st, retainer $5. And he reads a couple more of those.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he is a man who seems to, through somewhat mysterious means, come into contact with people who have recently been the subject of gossip in high society. Yes. And then he makes those rumors go away. It's never exactly clarified how, although we later see that he has quite a few newspaper printers under his thumb. So we can assume that has something to do with it.
But there's sort of kind of this hint of blackmail that we're starting to get among, I mean, who else, but then who can pay, you know?
Yeah, which is, yeah, I have another quote actually just a page or two later about that. So Hildred is now talking to him about whether or not it's wise to keep so many people under your thumb like this. "They may turn on you," I suggested. He rubbed his thumb over his cropped ears and adjusted the wax substitutes. "I think not," he murmured thoughtfully. "I seldom have to apply the whip, and then only once. Besides, they like their wages." How do you apply the whip?" I demanded. His face for a moment was awful to look upon. His eyes dwindled into a pair of green sparks. "I invite them to come up and have a little chat with me," he said in a soft voice. So, yeah, all throughout, there's these implications that he's, not only is he making these secrets go away, he's hanging on to them, which, you know, I can't think of any other powerful men who have possibly held on to incriminating secrets about powerful people.
This is a fun little bit that we do where we pretend like we're dancing around what we're obviously talking about. But yeah, that does seem to be a common theme in politics, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got dirt on somebody, use it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's super fascinating because you're like, okay, so who is this guy that he's like this evil goblin-esque man who lives above an armorer and somehow has blackmail on everybody, but he's also gearing up for this sort of plan.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe the plan that him and Hildred are embroiled in?
So the plan sort of slowly unfolds throughout the story. We get bits and pieces of it. Initially, all we get is he hands him a manuscript called The Imperial Dynasty of America, which traces these lost lineages of like kings and emperors from areas such as, say, Carcosa, most notably. But also the Hyades, Hastor, and Aldebaran.
Yes.
And finally, we notice that one of these people is Louis Castain, who is our friend Hildred's cousin. And so he is currently the rightful king of America, according to this manuscript. Although, of course, he would serve the king in yellow, this sort of mysterious greater power who seems to loom over everything that happens. And of course, they know of the play, which Hildred seems to think, is describing some form of reality, or it's a coded message.
Right. Do we want to kind of pivot and talk about the play real quick?
Yeah, for sure.
Our
first glimpse. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, so I'll read like a quote from Hildred about like what the play is. So just straight from the mouth of the guy, the mouth of the horse, is that it? I don't know. But anyway, so here's a couple quotes. He says, "If I had not caught a glimpse of the opening words in the second act, I should never have finished it. But as I stopped to pick it up, my eyes became riveted to the open page, and with a cry of terror, or perhaps it was joy, so poignant that I suffered in every nerve, I snatched the thing from the hearth and crept shaking to my bedroom, where I read it and reread it and wept and laughed and trembled with a horror which at times assails me yet. This is the thing that troubles me, for I cannot forget Carcosa, where black stars hang in the heavens, where the shadows of men's thoughts lengthen in the afternoon, when the twin suns sink into the lake of holly, and my mind will bear forever the memory of the pallid mask." And then another quote is, "No definite principles had been violated in these wicked pages, no doctrine promulgated, no convictions outraged. It could not be judged by any known standard. Yet, although it was acknowledged that the supreme note of art had been struck in The King in Yellow, all felt that the human nature could not bear the strain, nor thrive on words in which the essence of purest poison lurked. the very banality and innocence of the first act only allowed the blow to fall afterwards with more awful effect. I really like these quotes because the way he just sort of dances around what even this play is and just gives you like hints at it's really cool. It reminds me of kind of the same sort of device used in Pulp Fiction of like when they open the briefcase and there's just a beautiful glow. You have no idea what it is, but you're like, oh, that's valuable. And that's all you really need to know.
Yeah,
and
it's like the evil version of that.
Exactly. And in this, you're like, oh, this is spooky. And it's driving people crazy or not.
And that's sort of a recurring theme throughout is once you start reading, if you make it into the second act, it seems like no one stops once they get to that point. Like at that point, it gets its claws in you.
Yes.
But
and it's also like within the lore of this story sort of like banned because of this.
Yeah, which of course only had the effect of making it even more sought after by the sort of bohemians of society. So we can pick up the pace a little bit. I wanted to take our time in the world just to sort of set everything up, like, you know, this play, the concept, the characters.
Right.
So from there, Hildred sort of like goes around. He meets up with his cousin Lewis, who he seems to hate. And Lewis and Constance are hanging out. Hildred freaks out once again at Hauberk for implying that he's crazy. And then it's slowly the plans comes to more and more fruition. He at one point takes out this like heavy laden golden crown from a timer safe. And then he sort of puts it back in and he acknowledges that the king in yellow might scorn such a thing, but he would wear it proudly. As time goes on, is revealed, he plans to have Lewis either murdered or exiled, thereby making himself the rightful king.
Yeah, of, next in the line of succession.
Yeah, the American dynasty. And Wilde has sent out the yellow sign to the tens of thousands of followers he has throughout this throughout this world.
Yeah, and this is the point where you go, oh, he's crazy.
You're like, oh, things are going off the rails. Yes. He like... Later on, he invites Lewis over to his apartment and, like, shows him the crown, which he just casually notes, like, Lewis is like, ah, look at this, like, cute little tin thing that's, like, made out of, like, hammered brass. And he's like, ah, this fool. And then he very casually mentions putting it back in the safe timer. He says, although Lewis called it a bread box for some reason.
That's very fun.
That was a very good touch.
That's a good touch.
Wilde and Hildred... arrange to have Constance and Hauberk murdered so they can keep England out of the affair because they don't want to complicate things by adding in a new royal line of succession, right? And the murderer, it's not entirely clear what happens because they do see the guy who they paid to do it. They blackmailed him, of course, using Wilde's particular set of skills, Liam Neeson voice. they see him run into the suicide chamber and kill himself. So they imagine, he must have done the job.
Right.
At which point, Hauberk tells Lewis the truth and insists that he surrender the throne and informs him that, like, Constance and Hauberk have been killed. He must simply go into exile or be killed. Lewis is like, no, let's get you some help, buddy. And at the very end, we see Constance come back out. It has been shown that Wilde was torn apart, possibly by his cat. although it's also possible that it was by like Frank, the guy who hired him, or Hildred, the insane lunatic who he's been hanging out with. there's a lot of possibilities. And he is dragged away off to a sanitarium of some variety. Do you want to read the closing quote or should I?
He says, I see it now, I shrieked. You have the seized the throne and the empire. Woe, woe to you who are crowned with the crown of the king in yellow.
Editor's note.
Mr. Castain died yesterday in the asylum for the criminal insane, which is pretty funny. That's a good punchline.
He's got a couple banger endings in these stories, I must say.
Yeah, I think so too. The next one is my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
As we'll get to. But yeah, so... interesting story. It's very easy to get lost in this one, but like it sets up some interesting themes where I'm like, okay, blackmail of the elite, huge conspiracy that maybe exists, play that seems to drive people insane.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. And I think part of why I like this one so much is I read it and just imagined that I was someone reading it in 1895.
That's true.
I don't know what you would have done with this.
Yeah.
Like, because prior to that, I guess you have like your Edgar Allan Poe's and your Mary Shelley's. But this just feels almost like you're looking at the world through like a grimy lens, almost. Like that sense of uneasiness the entire time where you're like, something is wrong.
It's very interesting. It's the only thing I could think from that time period to equate it to would be like the Telltale Heart. And even mm-hmm. then, like, not really, because that's a little, I don't know, like, this is very...
That one feels a little pulpier, almost.
And this feels very, like, modern. Mm-hmm. Like, I could see that being kind of like a Black Mirror type of episode, where you're just like, it's kind of grim and dour, and like, you're like, how did you think of this, first off?
Yeah, it's like, it's a warning, the ending of it is a warning about, like, internet conspiracy theories or something.
Exactly.
Wow, yeah. Brilliant. Next story, The Mask.
The Mask.
Your favorite, so I'll let you take the lead on this one.
Songs that the Hyads shall sing, where flap the tatters of the king, must die unheard in dim Carcosa. So this is The Mask. It's a lot shorter than the other one, and this is kind of where we get that callback to earlier in the story where we mentioned Boris Yvain, who is one of the three main characters of this one. Essentially, we kind of start with this like friend group of artists, of rich mm-hmm. kind of upper crust, upper middle class artists in Paris, I believe. We've got the narrator, Alec, who I believe is a painter, his friend Boris, who is a sculptor, and their friend Genevieve, who's kind of a love interest to both of them, who does something probably. I'm not sure if she's an artist. I can't remember. But anyway, we open kind of with this like vignette of – that's not the right use of that word. But we open with this sort of kind of scene of Boris dropping a lily into this milky white foam and then pulling it out, and it's left behind is like a kind of marbly like stone – sculpture. So he's come up with this like alchemical way to turn living organisms into stone. And so him and it's actually kind of, I really like the rapport between him and Alec, the main character.
Yeah, this story, it's the one exception to the rule of like everything feeling like creepy and evil is like this story, which is just kind of a nice love story at the end of the day.
It's kind of sweet. Yeah. And like, even like, I think he probably was very intentional, like as a palate cleanser from mm-hmm. like evil schizoid narrator to like a guy who's kind of just nice, and like him and his friend like each other a lot, and like you know, like they have this fun banter where he's like, he's come up with this amazing process and he's like, yeah, I'm gonna destroy it because like you know, like this will only be used for evil, and his friend's like, ooh, I'm gonna steal it from you and I'm gonna become rich, and like they have that fun little playful banter and you're like, wow, like that's kind of a very, I guess, realistic.
Yeah, there's a scene later on where like he's making fun of Boris, and so Boris threatens to dunk him, and then they realize that he almost like threw him into the statue chemical.
Yeah.
And they both just sort of go like, oof. Maybe we shouldn't goof around in the chemistry lab so much.
And then this is kind of where we're introduced to the fact that they both love Genevieve, and Alec, our protagonist, mentions how he kind of like gave, you know, he made his love clear to Genevieve, and she was kind of like, ah, no, I love Boris. And so he's being cool about it. He's like, no, I want them both to be happy. We're all still friends. And it's, you're like, uh-oh, pretty mature, dude. Good work, you know? And so they all kind of have this fun friendship where they just do art and apparently don't have jobs, I guess.
They're all just the classic rich artists who hang out in Paris all day in the 1890s.
And then, you know, we get this idea that Boris is going to try to like do this with a bunny, and he's going to kind of work up and like see like what he can change with this alchemical process. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, I guess something happens where I'm blanking, so maybe fill me in on this, but
sure.
Like Genevieve like sprains her ankle somehow.
Yeah, it's not entirely made clear. So there's a brief moment. Alec has like a strange dream, and he thinks about the King in Yellow, right? Which of course he has read.
Right.
And he compares it. He compares his sort of like his pretending that he doesn't love Genevieve for their sake He compares it to the King in Yellow's pallid mask that he wears, which notably in an opening quote for this, the Yellow King, in the only like quote from the actual play that isn't like the poem that we have been sprinkling throughout, this quote where he's confronted by two women who bid him to take off his mask because presumably he's at a masquerade or something. So you also have a Mask of the Red Death reference there, of course. And the King in Yellow responds creepily with, "I have no mask," or "I wear no mask." I don't remember exactly what it is. And so that mask sort of becoming a part of you is the very obvious theme for this story. But I like a very obvious theme sometimes. It's
nice. I do too. Well, and I think it's kind of a nice theme too, because his whole mask is that, like, him being, like, the mask he's wearing is, pretending that he doesn't care, or not even pretending that he doesn't care, but just, like, being okay with Genevieve and Boris being a thing and not him, right? And you're kind of like, all right, good work, dude. And then she falls and sprains her ankle somehow. She trips over like a wolf pelt.
Yeah, she trips over a wolf pelt because he was so busy like dreaming in their parlor that he startled her.
Yes.
And, you know, being a woman in the 1890s, this immediately sends her into the throes of a dreadful fever.
Yeah. And so what do they do but give her drugs?
Yeah, they give her drugs.
And then in the height of, like, I guess a drug-induced mania, she runs and throws herself into the solution.
Well, but first...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, no, spoilers. Yeah, Chekhov's solution of statue chemical. At it again. So in this feverish, drugged-up state, she confesses that she loves Alec. And Boris and Alec are both like, oof, this is not good. I don't like this.
Yes, this is uncomfortable.
I don't think, does she tell Boris, or is it just Alec that hears it?
That's a good question.
Because I think he like mentions that he must like continue to wear the mask because he, she does tell Boris because he tells Boris, he's like, all right, here's what we're going to do. Once she makes a recovery, I'm going to spend a couple more days with you guys. Then I'm going to go on a trip and you're never going to see me again because I don't want to get in the way of what you guys have going on.
Right.
So Genevieve, upon recovering, learns that she has spilled this terrible secret. She has let the mask slip, if you would. And then she runs and jumps into the human-sized bathtub of chemicals that Boris has just been keeping around.
It's approximately Genevieve-sized.
Yeah. So she jumps in and sinks to the bottom, and of course she forms a beautiful but the very statue.
Yes.
And Boris shoots himself through the heart immediately.
Well, and all while this is happening, I guess Alec has fallen unconscious somehow.
Yeah, he's struggling as well. There's a lot of the classic convenient fever trope from this period, which I do kind of like. I wish we would have that more nowadays.
I do like that. So like he wakes up from the fever and he's like, ah, I'm glad I'm feeling better. Hey, where's Boris and Genevieve? And his other friend is like, bad news, friend. Boris shot himself in the heart and Genevieve declared her love for you and turned into rocks. And
I was like, oh, that's not good. And like, oh yeah, it's also been like 2 years.
He was
That's how I read it, was that he was like unconscious for like a year. But Boris has willed him the entire estate.
Yes. And they kind of covered it up. They Jack, which is the other friend, like very quickly, this is another scene that kind of like made me open my eye, because he's like, we've covered it up. We sent away the help. We've made everyone think Boris has had a heart attack and that Genevieve is away on a long
trip from which she will not return or something like that.
Something like that. And you're like, huh, okay, interesting. Do you have anything to say about that?
No, I mean, it is interesting, right? That two of these stories in quick succession feature very powerful people covering things up.
Yeah.
But then we get the ending that just feels nice. So we have, Alec is just sort of sulking around the mansion that he owns because, you know, his two dead friends have died and he's in a bad mood. And the maid walks in, she's like, someone stole the statue of the marble flower. Put an actual flower in its place. He's like, okay, leave me alone.
He's like, go away.
I'm too busy sulking to notice this.
And then he comes back with the goldfish, and she comes back with the goldfish that had been dipped, and she's like, same thing happened with the goldfish. And he's like,
Now it's like, okay,
put him
get
in the
it.
Tank.
Yeah. Leave me alone. I'm trying not to think.
And then she comes back with the bunny, and he's like, set it out. And then, like, you know, it hits him. Like,
he's wait a minute.
We've been screaming for like 10 paragraphs. And he's like, wait a second. And he runs into the room where Genevieve's statue was laid. And he sees her with a flushed face on her couch, you know, opening her sleepy eyes. And it's kind of this like sweet ending where you're like, oh, I mean, it's sad that Boris died, but like, they get to be together.
I guess. It's like, it's a good ending in that, like, this era of good ending, right? Where it's like, oh, how sweet. Now that her husband has killed himself, there is nothing in the way of their honor. But I mean, genuinely, it's bittersweet, but it is a very sweet ending. It's just a genuinely, obviously, it's still dark and weird, and the King in Yellow's presence is felt, but it's these guys come away the least scathed, which is to say only one of them dies, and at that, it's a fairly quick and painless one.
Absolutely. And like, I don't know, this one is kind of my favorite partially because of that, where like all the characters feel kind of nice. The ending is kind of nice, but it still has like that drama and that weirdness.
Yeah.
And kind of takes you on that roller coaster. And also just like the buildup of to like realizing that, oh man, Genevieve's going to come back to life too, because this chemical wears off after a certain amount of time. That's was such a great reveal. Honestly, I loved it.
Yeah, it was very nice. So the next one,
do you want to briefly talk about, because we talked about how Genevieve was just doing
drugs. Oh yeah, please. Yeah. Take a little side note.
They say that in like a throwaway line, which I was like, what?
Truly a different time.
Absolutely. And then it made me think of Sherlock Holmes, because like he was like, what, addicted to cocaine?
Yeah, just constantly doing like opium.
Yeah. So I like briefly looked into like drug abuse in the Victorian area. So I wanted to like read this like paragraph from the Smithsonian. So it says, quote, "Physicians used morphine as a newfangled wonder drug. Injected with a hypodermic syringe, the medication relieved pain, asthma, headaches, alcoholics, delirium, gastrointestinal diseases, and menstrual cramps. Doctors were really impressed by the speedy results they got," says David T. Courtwright, author of Dark Paradise, A History of Opiate Addiction in America. "It's almost as if someone had handed them a magic wand. By 1895, morphine and opium powders like Oxycontin and other prescribed opioids today had led to an addiction epidemic that affected roughly 1 in 200 Americans. Before 1900, the typical opiate addict in America was an upper-class or middle-class white woman." So I just ran that and I'm like, oh, that's interesting, because like the lady who gets abusing drugs is just like an 18-year-old white woman in like upper class France. And so I just thought that was interesting, because I'm like, we're kind of talking about these themes he keeps laying out, and he must have been this upper crust guy, right? And so he's just taking things he's noticing, which is like drug addiction, falling into a fever, you know, like romantic intrigues and trysts between these people who are just like hanging around making sculptures. And then like, you know, oh, guys who are blackmailing each other powerful people, you know. I don't know, it kind of like fit in that.
Yeah, I've got a couple other thematic notes that we'll touch on after we've... "Song of my soul, my voice is dead. Die thou unsung, as tears unshed shall dry and die in lost Carcosa." So yeah, we're gonna probably just gonna slam out these next two, because they're the shortest stories and also I think the least interesting ones. So In the Court of the Dragon, which has a very cool name that I think, frankly, it doesn't entirely live up to. Yeah. It tells the story of our narrator, who I don't believe is ever named. I might have just missed it.
I don't think he is.
But yeah, so he goes into a Catholic church. He's sitting down enjoying mass, and the organ player is just going wild. And he's like he's offended deeply that St. Barnaby, his favorite church, they've hired this like crazy organ player who's doing something wild. And this is also in 1850s Paris, I would like to note. So he gives the organist a dirty look and sees that this guy is just giving him the stink eye. Let me read the quote real quick. Let's see. "My eye left his face. I knew not for what reason, and sought the lower end of the church. The same man was coming out from behind the organ," because the organ player stops, and he's like, okay, let's see what this guy's deal is. Let's see, where is it? "But there had not been time for him to return. If he had returned, I must have seen him. I felt a faint chill, and my heart sank, and yet his going and coming were no affair of mine. I looked at him. I could not look away from his black figure, his white face. When he was exactly opposite to me, he turned and sent across the church straight into my eyes a look of hate, intense and deadly. I have never seen any other like it. Would to God I might never see it again. So the organist is really spooky, and it sort of freaks him out. So for the rest of the sermon, he can't really like pay attention. He like stands up and goes for a walk, and he sees the organist start to follow him home. So he runs home, and then suddenly he wakes back up in the church. And he's like, it was all just a silly dream. How foolish of me. And then he leaves the church and things are a little strange. And he realizes that he has somehow been transported into Carcosa. And so he looks around. Its mysterious towers rise behind the moon, and so on and so forth. And then this is the first and only time in these four stories that we see the actual King in Yellow himself as an entity, who greets our protagonist at the very end as he's sinking into the depths. He hears the King in Yellow whispering into his soul, "It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God." And that's the end of that story.
That's a sick ending.
Like I said, no notes on any of these endings. They all rock.
Yeah. One thing I want to mention is like earlier in the story, he does mention that like he had been reading the play, yes, The King in the Yellow. And that's part of the reason why he's come to church, because he's like,
He's like, it kind of freaked me out. I didn't.
Yeah.
So then let's see. The last one that we have is the yellow sign, which I liked a little bit more than in The Court of the Dragon, I think. So it tells the story of a painter who just kind of sucks. He's not a great guy. He's a womanizer. And we're back in 1920s America. And he has a young model named Tessie, who is just, she's very young and innocent, and in the creepy way that old painters who suck do, he's like, I care for her. I hope that she doesn't get married to some young fool before she can have her fun. And you're like, all right, chill, man.
Calm down, bro.
But so she mentions to him, she has a weird dream where she sees a coffin driving down the main street, driven by a black figure who has a creepy and pale face like a coffin worm, which is mentioned. I believe they make the same comparison in The Court of the Dragon as well. So these stories that are about 30 years apart feature this same mysterious character.
Right.
And this guy, he just sort of freaks people out. Everybody who sees him is like, he's a little weird. One guy says he punched him and like one of his fingers fell off, which I liked.
I like that.
And so after Tessie tells him about this dream, he has a dream the next night where he is in a coffin being driven along the carriage. And as he looks out through his coffin has a window, apparently. And as he looks out through the window, he sees Tessie in one of the windows. And he tells her this story in like a, isn't it silly? Can't you see that this dream doesn't mean anything? And she understandably freaks out at this revelation where he's like, the night after you had this dream, I had a dream in which I was dead and you were gazing upon my coffin. And she confesses that she's so sad because she cares for him. And then he kisses her. And then we have retreated to 4 or 5 pages of him just figuring out whether or not he wants to have an affair with his young student, which... Interesting.
Come on, dude.
In a very like weirdly self-aware sign, though, he like is acknowledging, he's like, I'm too evil for her. So good for him, I guess.
Yeah.
He passes the creepy pale figure once again, who whispers to him, "Have you found the yellow sign?" as he walks by, which, spooky.
Ooh.
And then, so the next day he gives her a necklace, and she in her delight gives him this pin that she just found it on a walk one day. But it's the gift that she gives him. It's this strange symbol. Yes. And they're all like, I wonder what that is. And then she discovers he can't paint because he's tripped and like a sprained both of his wrists. There's a lot of tripping in these stories.
A lot of pratfalls.
Yeah, the King in Yellow would be very different if you just had like a slide whistle. So he can't paint, so he's just kind of like hanging out. And Tessie's there too. I mean, she's got nothing better to do. She would have been at work anyway. And she looks around and she finds a copy of The King in Yellow. And he's like, "Yo, Tessie, my friend Castaigne read that and like went insane and murdered some people. Like, chill out. She's like, no, I'm going to go read it. And she runs off. She grabs it and runs off and then just disappears. He can't find her for like the next 2 hours. He searches his entire house and she's gone.
Yeah.
And then he eventually finds her in a hiding spot, just pale and shaking. And she has read the book. And so he sets her down on the couch. And then I think he also reads it just to sort of figure out what's going on. And they, in a trance-like state, just sort of they dissociate a little bit and they realize after a few hours of their discussion that they've been talking about the King in Yellow. At which point the pale corpse-like man walks into the room. He rots the door with just a touch of his fingers, which I thought was a really cool and creepy like note.
Yeah.
And Tessie just sort of dies as he enters the room. And then the corpse-like man falls to the ground and like instantly rots and decays. And the police run in because they heard a young woman screaming and find our painter surrounded by two dead bodies. So he is, of course, arrested. Although the police note that that man should have been dead for like several months.
Ooh.
And then finally, here's, I'm just going to read the last sentence in this thing, because I think it's really cool. He's writing this confession as the as a priest and a couple doctors are trying to figure out what to do with him. And so the last sentence in his confession is, "I am dying. I wish the priest would." And then it ends.
Like, and then it ends.
What happened? What happened to him?
Yeah. Which, I know what happened to him.
Yeah.
His wife found out about the affair.
She yeah, took away his journal.
She's like, no more journaling for you. You killed a lady. Yeah, that's an interesting one. I liked it a little bit less than the other ones.
Yeah, it's interesting because more literally than any of the other ones, it shows that the King in Yellow is a corrupting presence.
Yes.
Like they do this and then supernatural things occur around them. Oh, and it's yes. revealed, of course, that the pin that he has given bears the yellow sign.
The yellow sign of the King in Yellow.
Yeah. And I like that he doesn't really describe it, aside from saying, like, it doesn't look like any writing. For some reason, that's very... I love, like, things like that are just so...
Yeah.
Which is like, yeah, it's weird. I can't describe it anymore.
Yeah. Ooh. That's a very... Like, you can see where H.P. Lovecraft mm-hmm. was inspired by that, because a lot of his words are like, and then I saw it, and it was indescribable. And you're like, well, why am I reading this, man?
It is an insane grift that you're able to, like, just go, like, and then... Whatever scares you the most, look back at me. And people's like, wow, that was terrifying.
That's horrible.
So I do have a couple notes I would like to make just sort of about things I came across yeah. in this.
This is the pivot in the podcast where
the
we...
Pivot in the podcast.
Yeah,
we're
the classic.
A little bit of history, a little bit of spooky stuff.
Yeah.
First of all, I'd like to note Carcosa and these other, like many of these other names were not, these were not Robert W. Chambers originals.
Right.
They were, in fact, coined by one Ambrose Bierce, who just rocks. I've read this guy. I've read a little bit about this guy. I'm a big fan. But by most accounts, he was just incredibly cynical and just mean because he fought in the Civil War, or the Union, don't worry, and didn't like what he saw. So he like set about writing satire in a news column, and then also just in his spare time wrote incredibly influential horror stories and poetry, as you do. So he wrote a story called An Inhabitant of Carcosa, which very similarly to In the Court of the Dragon features a main character who wanders around this Carcosa place before he realizes that he is dead. And then that's the end of the story.
Ooh. Yeah.
So just some interesting notes about Ambrose Bierce. His newspaper column eventually got picked up by William Randolph Hearst, who, of course, tangled with our old friend William Stevenson from back in the day, who tried to drive him out of business and was ultimately unsuccessful.
Interesting.
And in his time there, this is the biggest eye emoji that I found, he stirred up a bit of controversy. Because following William McKinley's assassination, an old poem that he wrote about another figure's assassination, namely that of William Goebel, the governor of Kentucky, who's the only state governor to have been assassinated in office. He wrote a poem about this guy's assassination. So just a side note about Goebel, because I'd never heard this story. His assassins were never caught. He was shot a day before taking office and then held office for 3 days before dying in his bed. His assassins were never caught. There were rumblings throughout that the current governor, William Taylor, was involved because the election between them was nasty. Taylor won the popular vote by like a few thousand votes. And then a group of Democrats got together to steal the election. Like they formed this committee that like threw out a bunch of votes for Taylor and instead like declared Goebel the winner. And then there was a Stop the Steal style rally where a bunch of people showed up and like tried to steal back the election. And Goebel was shot at some point throughout this. None of the timelines are particularly clear. And then Taylor, in the classic move of a man who has not organized someone's murder, fled to Indiana, which it's kind of damning, I will admit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, just really weird story. I kind of want to look into that one a little more. But anyway, so our boy Bierce, wrote a poem about this. He wrote, "The bullet that pierced Goebel's breast cannot be found in all the West. For good reason, it is speeding here to stretch McKinley on his bier." A bier is it's like what you set a coffin on, which is ominous considering that, in 1900, William McKinley was shot and then our Teddy Roosevelt took power. So this, so McKinley, just as a side note, is one of the three people who is shot by either someone who is tangentially involved in left-wing activism or by someone who is deeply insane, because McKinley is up there with Kennedy and Reagan in terms of people who were mysteriously killed by this one-armed lunatic with a gun. Weird how that just keeps happening throughout American history. anyway, the controversy around this poem, because people started accusing Hearst of like knowing that McKinley was going to get killed.
Yeah.
And like predictive programming style, having Bierce like write poems about it, I guess.
Yeah.
But the controversy around this was great enough that it ended his plans to run for president. And curiously, his membership in the Bohemian Club, which is a little odd. He just got kicked out of that, the Bohemian Club, of course, for our listeners who do not know. That was founded exactly 150 years ago now. It's a playground for all the sus movers and shakers of the world, right? And they also, coincidentally, grant temporary membership to the university presidents in the area and local military leaders, which I'm sure is a good sign that they're up to good things.
Oh, yeah.
As we mentioned, I'm just going to burn through the rest of my notes because I know we're a little low on time. But as we mentioned, Chambers inspired Lovecraft, a bunch of the other works to come after him. And they all deal with this very interesting theme. I just kind of wanted to put it out there, right? This idea of like these unknowable conspiracies or things that drive you insane. And we sort of coyly alluded to Epstein earlier, but I think there's a reason that in True Detective, which I know you're watching through Roswell, so I won't spoil it, but these works get alluded to because I think in a way, a lot of these conspiracies are almost Lovecraftian in their scope and the terrible things that are done.
Absolutely.
And I think that's part of what makes it such a compelling metaphor, right? This idea of something where reading all the way through it or looking upon it will sort of drive you crazy or cause you to snap a little bit.
Yeah.
Is, I think, a very compelling thing for someone, especially like us, like we aren't experts by any means, but we do sort of look into the vortex every now and then, and it can
take
a toll on you.
We do what Nietzsche told us not to do.
Exactly. Yeah, we stare into the void and just let it look back.
We let it look right at us. Yeah, it's a very fascinating theme that starts to pop up. I was trying to think of any other fiction that kind of has that theme before this. I couldn't come up with anything. Is there anything that you know of that fits into this category that predates this kind of Victorian era into the modern era?
Not really. I will say, actually, my final note on this, sort of contemporary to this, is something by one Oscar Wilde, a name which I'm sure was completely accidentally placed in there by Chambers and not a very intentional allusion. So Wilde, of course, is most people know, I guess, was a playwright, author, in England at this exact same time. In, I believe it was 1895 when he got arrested for getting a little too close to the son of a local noble who did not take a liking to him and basically had him imprisoned. But Wilde wrote, you know, the Picture of Dorian Gray, a book all about, and it only alludes to it, right? Because that's all you can do at this time period. But it alludes to all sorts of things that these elites are doing and these like mysterious practices they're doing, these weird dark rituals. Although, of course, that one is, I guess, a little more accidental in the Picture of Dorian Gray. But still, again, that theme pops up, right, of these elites doing these terrible things and the sort of effect that it takes on your soul, but the fact that eventually you just grow a little calloused to it. I think it is notable, right, that Wilde in Chambers's story is the repairer of reputations. He's this man who knows all these terrible secrets and then later meets a terrible end for it. And of course that happened prior. He published this prior to Wilde's imprisonment and sort of subsequent death. But
do you think when that happened, he was like, called it?
He felt the same way that I felt when like Epstein was on like national TV. I'm like, he turned don't to you like feel foolish.
He turned to like a disdainful girlfriend and was like, ha ha ha. Now who's crazy?
Which for listeners of the podcast, I assure you, I did not do when the news about Epstein hit mainstream sources. No women from my past heard about it that day.
Good. You had some good, good self-control.
Those are really all of my notes. I did just want to point out the Wilde connection because thank you.
That's fascinating. I did not pick up on that, honestly, till you mentioned it because I guess I just hadn't, I didn't think about the fact that this was the exact same time period as Oscar Wilde. That's very interesting. I guess what would our summary be on this? Is it going to be a to be continued for when we hop into subjects like, I don't know, like the Franklin scandal, like that type of stuff that we're eventually going to have to go towards?
Yeah, when you finish True Detective, I do kind of want to talk about it because I think it is, as it goes on, you'll see. And listeners, please, I encourage you, watch True Detective. It's great and it is all real. There is no fiction in that show.
Matthew McConaughey is cool.
And also sucks a little bit. I guess that does.
And also is me.
He's just like me.
I was laughing thinking about, because I've only watched the first episode, but they're bouncing between like young McConaughey and he's like, you know, he's all put together, but he's like, I'm cool. And then like the older McConaughey and he's like all like horrifying looking.
With the long hair,
And I was thinking like, that's me before and after this podcast.
And so the first time I watched it, I thought that young McConaughey with like the short and cropped hair was you. And then old McConaughey was me.
Interesting. That's fascinating.
Gaunt face and long, shaggy, unkempt hair. I think when we finish True Detective, we'll sort of maybe revisit this and the presence of like these cosmic elements in more mundane conspiracies. Well, there may be ritual aspects to it. Who knows? But I think, ultimately this is just sort of like a lot of really good works that sort of deal with conspiracy. There's no concrete takeaway from this. It's more just a feeling and it's the sort of thing. If you were to just approach this as a literary thing and not with this sort of angle or interpretation in mind, I feel like a lot of the, and because political intrigue is a very real part of some of these stories, and I feel like it might sort of fly over your head and sort of be taken as like just an interesting plot point instead of, I think he was trying to make some very real points about society at large and sort of the rumblings that occur within the elite as they interact with each other.
Yeah.
But, you know, absolutely, you can only really gesture towards it. No one's ever going to let you make a show that's like, here are the names of the people in the flight logs, right?
Here's Mitch McConnell's address. Go get him.
Do with this what you will.
Do with this what you will. Yeah. No, I think that's a good takeaway. And I think it's just kind of, it paints an interesting picture of like that, the elites and like, I guess just sort of the temperature of the water at that time period and the things we can kind of relate with now and you know what changes and what doesn't. It's kind of essentially like when we think about our Gilles de Rais episode where we looked at a lot of the stuff that happened, you know, with essentially, you know, all the political stuff surrounding his trial, where it's like, yes, we caught the one bad guy who's doing the one thing. So, yeah. So it's just, it's again, it's that classic historic esoteric theme of it's spiritually true that there is an evil yellow king guiding all of politics and evil things happening in this world. And that guy's name? Satan.
I mean, who knows? But you know, especially when I was reading the thing about Wilde, right? This man who makes so much money blackmailing the elites.
Yeah.
You know, I was reminded of Subliminal Jihad, of course, and their classic refrain, "Nothing new under the sun," right?
Yeah.
As a side note, I do recommend their episode on Bohemian Grove for those of you who wish to know more.
I might have to listen to
that. I don't remember if it's on their Patreon or not, but it is. As a side note, their Patreon is also just worth it. So.
Oh,
subscribe
absolutely.
To Subliminal Jihad. I'm sure that they need our massive listenership to go help them out.
They need Michael and his four burner accounts.
I think that is about it for at least my thoughts on this. I will say, go read The King in Yellow.
Yeah, and it's good.
Maybe The Maker of Moons, too. I haven't read it yet, but man, what a title.
It's a good title.
You can follow the show on Twitter at HistEsoteric and Instagram at HistoricaEsoterica, because they let us have a full handle there. Nice. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube. We have a little channel. There's a great animation you got a little UFO going up in the corner. There's all sorts of fun things going on. Little fireplace. It feels cozy but spooky.
Ooh.
Much like The Mask. I think that does it. So I would just encourage you all to read The King in Yellow, to remember that he's out there, and finally remember that it's all connected.
During my convalescence, I had bought and read for the first time The King in Yellow.
Know about him? I'll tell you about the Yellow King.
For I read it and reread it and wept.